You're listening to WWBC Cocoa, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in Cocoa, Florida. We're heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and my goodness, all over God's magnificent planet on the World Wide Web.
That's right. I am Ellen O'Neill. I'm the co-host here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and yes, we are heard all over the World Wide Web. If you tune into 1510wwbc.com, you'll see a listen live button, and you can get us on any one of your streaming devices. Or if you'd like to hear one of our archive shows, you can select the on-demand button and choose by date. Usually within 24 hours, we have everything up on our website and also on our Facebook pages, where you'd be able to search by name and by topic, and that's on cedamediainc.com and also on Facebook under Ceda Media Inc., and under Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And once again, 14 years of fantastic shows, great guests, and today is no different, and we've got people calling in from other parts of the world today.
That's right.
So exciting.
And so for listeners who are tuning in for the first time or are dedicated listeners, just a friendly reminder that our show is run basically by people helping us to sponsor the segments, which we're very grateful for ongoing sponsors and those guests that help us to cover the airtime as well. Ellen and I sit here on Mondays, and we talk to people from all over the world, and right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida, right here in Brevard as well. And we talk about topics that we try to call table topics.
Kitchen tables. Right.
It's the topics that you should be having, actually, around your kitchen table, which a lot of people don't even have a kitchen table anymore. Right. They just sit wherever they want to sit. And we talk about things like financial literacy, running for office.
Authors.
We talk to so many authors and writers, and we speak to people about the environment, leaving a good footprint behind on planet Earth.
Activists that are trying to make a difference in the world, like our guests today.
Right, singers, actors, yeah. Directors, producers, whatever. We have a platform, and we are fair and balanced.
That's right.
Extremely fair and balanced. And Ellen, you know, one of the great things about our show is we recognize that all of us learn from each other. We learn from other people's cultures. We learn from education. God knows we learn from the people that came before us and our life experiences.
That's right.
And look at you this morning. By the grace of God, you didn't get hit by that guy. But look, it's a good thing you're a God-fearing person.
I know.
And you prayed.
And she's not talking about being physically hit. I was driving here. It was as anyone knows,
the harrowing traffic experience.
The traffic in everyone's town these days is a little heavy, so... and of course, with the heat wave that we're having, it makes everybody a little more agitated.
Well,
so
I kind of wish you could have slowed down and say to that guy, what was the whole big issue of you being a couple inches from my bumper, harassing me on the road, and to get away to the same traffic light?
Exactly.
And really, and then you caused a rock to hit my windscreen, and now I have to call Safe Light? Really?
Right.
But if you do that, he might have a gun and he might come out and shoot you, and then I won't have a co-host.
And once again, I say the same thing. Go with the grace of God. I hope whatever was making you go fast, I hope you're okay. And I say them, send them a little prayer, and I just call my insurance company and take care of it.
Yeah.
God bless
just saying them the fact stay that and I breathe, have it, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
So today, for our listeners who are tuning into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, we have two really great guests. And, you know, God sends me the greatest people of all times for this radio show. We've got a gentleman who's going to be calling in the second segment. His name is Sean O'Neill, and he's an award-winning screenwriter and filmmaker. And he is going to talk to us about his books and his films. And I feel like I know him already because his wife is Indian, like me, which is really good. The first segment, I was just watching a really nice video on the way here about people, the fatherless epidemic. And the gentleman who's on the phone is with a Christian website called www.christianparenting.org. And his name is Eric Swithin. Served 4 years in the United States Marine Corps, received his BA in economics from Rice University, and his Master of Arts in Theology. He's one of those gentlemen that's been to other countries, was in Iraq, saw a lot of stuff, started questioning his own life, his own path, growing up with or without love, and talks a lot about his grandparents and how he was raised. And he decided that one of the main things missing in today's world are father figures for children, not just boys, but girls as well. And I like what he had to say, so we've rescheduled his segment a couple of times, and he's on the phone, and we're going to say hello to him. So good morning, Mr. Eric Swithin, and thank you for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our show is very fun. It's very valuable. We give out very valuable information. It's interesting. And we feel like we educate the public as well and people who are interested in learning something new. So thank you. So tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your ministry and the Alliance for Ending the Fatherless Epidemic.
Well, first and foremost, you know, I am a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus. I am all about the gospel and making a difference and an impact in this world by bringing in His kingdom and bringing glory to His name. So if there's one thing anybody needs to know about me, that's it. And with the fatherless epidemic, what's interesting is I really didn't know God as a perfect, loving daddy. For the longest time, I thought He was this punitive, distant deity, and kind of like a bully with a magnifying glass on an anthill. And I realized that the root of that belief was foundationally in the fact that I didn't have a loving dad growing up. He wasn't very present. And so most of the experiences I had with my mom's boyfriends and husbands and other adult figures, mentor-like figures, they were not positive ones. And so I had this really skewed perception of who God is because of those earthly experiences with earthly-like dads. And so that really led me to a deep dive into this issue. And being a guy that loves statistics, I have found that the vast majority of all, not some, but all of our societal issues are rooted in fatherlessness. And if you look at those that are in prison, if you look at economic issues, if you look at addiction, suicide, even sexual crimes, so much of it is utterly rooted in fatherlessness.
Yes.
Which makes sense, right? That we would have an enemy that tries to skew our perception of a loving heavenly father by destroying families, one family at a time, so that we would have a very skewed perception of a loving father figure in heaven, right?
Well, yeah, you make a lot of sense, and you've got great points. But, you know, like, for what we're seeing in today's world, too, it's not, there's so many outside influences, right? We were just talking about, in our studio this morning, about the outside influences of, like, corporations. Like, what responsibility does people bear to others in our world? We're watching, you know, young children who have to go to a daycare at 6:30 in the morning because you need the two incomes in order for families to thrive and survive. We're watching single moms that don't have Medicaid in certain states because we didn't, you know, expand Medicaid so people can have health care. All these things, you know, they are reasons why so many families are broken. We had a friend once on the show, and she was talking to us, and she said she also is in a ministry like yourself, and we came to the conclusion that if you have faith, if you have family, if you have food, if you have a little finances and trusted friends, you're good. And I think a lot of people today, they don't have those things. And you hit the nail right on the head, because we do believe that faith plays a big part in the family. So how do you mentor the people in your ministry, when, because it's not just about fathers not being in the homes, it's about the finances in that home as well, that's leading to so many people having issues at home.
And I would add just one more thing to it, too. It, you know, there's lots of families that are out there and they have two and three jobs. And what I found, the folks that are in my circle, when I went and showed them how to budget, they realized that maybe they didn't need to be working that much and maybe just a little bit more budgeting help and figuring out how to make their family work a little bit better financially was the right way to do it. And then now they do have the time to go back and spend time on the family. That's a big piece.
Mr. Swinton also helps mentors people with that.
Right.
So Mr. Swinton, are you seeing that there are multiple factors involved and issues with the family, not just having the father?
There are, but ultimately we're talking description versus prescription, right? And so there's a multitude of factors that are leading to the fall of our society, the downfall of our society. And so fatherlessness is at the root of that, but the cause of it, right? We can look at how the church has outsourced their responsibilities to the government. We can blame the family court system. We can look at the fact that most families are just trying to scrape by. They're in debt. They're living above their means. We can look at all these different factors, but at the end of the day, at least we can agree that fatherlessness is at the root of most of our societal ills, and then we can transition to what the prescription is. So what do we do about it? How do we change the course of history? How do we turn this ship around? And I think beyond a shadow of a doubt, it comes to mentorship and it comes to teaching people the ways of God, to simplify our life, to put our priorities in order. You know, for example, if you have a family that's working multiple jobs, they're trying to scrape by, they're living above their means, if Christ gets into that household and the parents begin to shift their priority to the kids above all these other things, they're going to readjust their life to pay more attention to the kids and to focus on raising their family the right way, to be present in the lives of their kids. For example, if there's a fatherlessness issue in our country, like there is, for the church to wake up to this issue and realize, yes, this is one of the primary issues we're facing, if the church would wake up to that, which I think they are, I think the phrase fatherless epidemic is now a household phrase, well, now the church has to put the prescription out there, which is men need to rise up and begin to pour into kids in their pews, pour into kids across the railroad tracks, where those kids don't have a positive role model. It's the church's responsibility. Who else is responsible for making a difference in our culture?
Right.
Should we look to corporations? Should we look to the government? Who should we look to? I think the prescription has to lie with God's people.
Right. Well, you know, I think you're talking about something that's also very cultural, right? Because I'm from the Caribbean. My background is Indian. And in our culture, the families, the grandmothers, the aunts, the cousins, the neighbors, we are the village. We are our village. So if we recognize a family that's in crisis and needs help, whether the father passed away from the family, whether it's a divorce situation, whether it's violence in the home, people step up to help. And I think what I'm hearing you saying is the foundation for everything starts at home. But we need to help people and mentor them so they can make their foundation solid, so they can raise children that are successful, educated children and students in today's world. Because I am seeing, like I'm a nurse in a nursing facility. I've been for 33 years. And I'll be honest with you, we see people from all walks of life where there is no compassion, there's no love, there's no empathy. And you question yourself, what kind of earth are we leaving behind for the next generation? And I think what I'm hearing you saying is we can fix it, and you're saying that we fix it through the love of Jesus Christ. But there are also other cultures and other religions that are doing this and doing it well as well.
Well, I think that ultimately what we're discovering, there is a fatherless epidemic globally, and it's not just here. We released our documentary in 73 languages, and we're seeing that it's a problem cross-culturally here in America, but we're also getting contacted from people in South Africa, people in France, people in Costa Rica. And so I think as the world continues to industrialize and become more and more modern, I think a lot of Western values are passed down the line to some of these other cultures. So traditional cultures where ultimately the tribe is pouring into each other's families. It takes a village, as you said, right?
Yes.
I think a lot of those traditional values, we're seeing them fall globally. It's not just happened. I think America is certainly ahead of the curve in the West, but we're seeing this take place all over the world. So what is the prescription? I don't believe there is another solution besides Jesus. I just do not. I don't see any fruit anywhere else other than people who know Christ and who have the motivation to bring his kingdom to fruition. And what does his kingdom look like? It looks like healthy families. And in the instances where there's an orphan or someone who's fatherless, it looks like people willing to step up. And I guess one of the great stories that we have so many tremendous stories we could share, but one of my unofficially adopted sons is a kid who had 6 suicide attempts. And when we met him, he was just completely broken. He's without a dad, and he is a sweet, sweet boy. Now he's a man. He's in college. He's also serving in the Army. He is a functioning member of society. He's given his life to Christ. He now has peace in his heart. He now has wholeness in his mind, and he's thriving and flourishing. And really what it came down to was he needed a man in his life that could point him to Jesus, that could love on him and teach him life skills, teach him what it means to be a man, teach him what it looks like to have a healthy, loving family, what marriage should look like or could look like, what it looks like to be a parent who really pours into their kids and puts their family as the biggest priority, only second to God himself. And so we've seen story after story of success where people are willing to get out of the pews and not just talk about being a Christian, but they're willing to actually do something about it. They see that neighborhood kid who's always by himself, or maybe, you know, a kid that's, you know, on your kid's sports team, their soccer team, and the dad's never on the sideline because he's not in the kid's life. And
right,
that family,
so
they
you
love
are just,
Jesus, they're
so,
willing to pour into him.
Yeah, so what you're noticing is people are stepping up to offer guidance. And that's
exactly right.
Right, and that's one of the things that Colin Powell, General Powell, had talked about, I think, in his book, about the guidance and how important it is to mentor the young people, like you say, not just in America, but around the world. And you're absolutely correct. Because we are noticing back home in Trinidad and Tobago, we are noticing, the violence is on the rise. Poverty is on the rise with certain segments of society. And yes, a lot of the elders are now saying that that is also being caused by the lack of fathers, because statistics are showing that the suicide rates, the runaways, the behavioral disorders, the high school dropouts,
right,
juvenile detention rates, substance abuse, aggression, all these are factors of houses that don't have a mentor or father figure. So tell us a little bit about your movie and how and the documentary you guys made, and how did that come about?
It's pretty amazing how it came about. My dad, my biological father, he wasn't really in my life much growing up. And later in my life, after I got back from the Iraq War, we really began to bond. And we reconciled and became really close friends. And after becoming really close friends and being a part of each other's lives for a few years, I got a phone call one day that he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And fortunately, you know, they gave him about 3 months, but he was able to live almost 3 years after the diagnosis. And he's in the film. And then right after the release of the film, we released the film, and then he ended up passing away a couple of weeks later. But when I received word that he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, I was sitting on the porch of my house overlooking the Rocky Mountains, and I was just talking to God and mourning the fact that, you know, now I have this father in my life who is, you know, a good friend of mine, and we're growing close, and then, you know, he's going to be taken away from me. And in that moment, I really believe I heard from God. And I received just this download into my thoughts of this movie idea, and not just a broad idea, but like an actual detailed storyboard for what this movie looked like. So I called a friend in Hollywood, and he makes movies for a living, and told him about the idea, and he said that it would be really successful, but maybe we could tone down the faith elements of the film a little bit in order to make it more palatable for the masses. And we just said, no way, that is not what we feel called to do. We really wanted to make Jesus the center of attention in the film, and to show the redemption that's possible through him. There is really no other way for someone to be like me, who should be dead or in prison, to be utterly redeemed and now be a functioning member of society and a loving husband and father is just a beautiful, miraculous story. And then to wrap that around my dad as he's dying and to be a part of that journey as he's leaving this earth, and then to also see the breaking of generational curses. You see, as far back as I can trace my family's heritage, it's been suffering. It's been problems with addiction. It's been divorce and infidelity and crime and all these things. My family's history is super dark.
I think
with me is just phenomenal.
Mr. Spitton, I think you're describing a lot of families when you talk about those issues, because there's so many people that do have things happening in their families, and it's pretty much swept under the rug because people don't talk about issues such as those in their families. But I have to applaud you, because, you know, we all understand the importance of having a father in a child's life is great, but not everyone is fortunate enough to have a stepfather or a father who loves them and wants to guide them and protect them and expect great things from them as far as academics or trade or whatever it is. And this is where it's so important for all of us to understand how important it is for the communities in which we live to step up, the elders in the community, the clergy, the faith-based folks such as yourself. And, I mean, I can't stress enough how we see that a lot here where we live as well. So how do you encourage more people to be someone like you that takes your life story and you've seen what your faith has done for you and put that into other people's and their actions and how they help others?
That's a really good question. You know, at the end of the day, I think that Christianity is really, really boring unless you're involved in God's work. I think that being a disciple and being discipled, being a follower of Jesus, should be painted on a canvas that is mission. And so I think what's really been the most beautiful part of my whole life has been being able to serve. We oftentimes think that service and volunteering and being involved in philanthropy is a drudge, or it just takes too much effort, or we just don't have the time to do that. But what I found was when families or people from the church are willing to go out and serve food at a soup kitchen, or they begin to pour into kids that don't have a good father figure, or you name it, or they're trying their best to make a dent in the sex trade industry and do their best to end that kind of corruption. What I have seen time and time again is that people who are nominal Christians, we're going to call them lukewarm Christians, they're sort of one foot in, one foot out. They might go to church every week, or they might only go to church on holidays, certain holidays. When they start actually being the hands and feet of Jesus, they start actually serving people and doing the types of things that Jesus demonstrated to us, loving on the poor and visiting the prisoner and, you know, praying for the sick and mentoring the orphan, man, they come alive in their faith. I can say that serving is not a drudge. It's literally the greatest part of my life. It's one of the most fulfilling things that I get to do, to pour into young people and to see their hearts healed and to see them become productive members of society. But even more than that, to break the generational curses. So kids that should be dead or in prison, kids that have a very high likelihood of ending up in a really disastrous situation, they end up becoming amazing family members, amazing wives or amazing husbands, and being great parents themselves. And so they break those generational curses off, just like I was able to do through Christ. And it ends up just being absolutely beautiful. So how do you get involved? You just start doing it. And you find something that you're heart is broken over. Find a cause, whether it's for the fatherless or whatever. Find something that breaks your heart.
Well, something
and go
you
do that
something
thing.
You're passionate about. It's like when I was listening to your video, you said when you went up in the mountains how you felt because you were able to find your quiet space and think. And I think in my religion, in Hinduism, we call that meditation. And I found it very beautiful that you were able to appreciate nature in such a way and think about your life and how, where were you going, what's your next step, you're going forward. And so for our listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with Mr. Eric Swithin, and he is with, he just made a film called The Fatherless Epidemic, and it's really amazing the work you've done, Mr. Swithin, because I have to tell you that I have had so many patients in the last 33 years in my nursing career as a long-term nurse, and people would say to them, well, what is your secret for living to be over 100 years old? And they would always say, faith in Jesus Christ, an apple a day, and oatmeal. So you have hit that right on the head to what the patients were saying in your belief. And I love all religions, and I think they all teach us good things. And it's up to us to take the good and interpret it the way we want to be a decent human being, give to others, be kind, be compassionate, be non-judgmental, and promote what you said Jesus would do, which is love everyone. And my friend Ellen wants to jump in here as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I believe everything, I don't know that I've heard it explained so eloquently before. So thank you for the program that you're delivering to the masses. And certainly thanks for sharing it all on Viewpoint with Sita and friends. Because we have, as you said, the fatherless epidemic is, or pandemic almost, right? Epidemic is a worldwide problem. And here we are here in Florida. Sita and I are looking at each other, reminding ourselves of the same people that are trying to do and make differences here in Brevard County for the same reasons.
Right, and Mrs.
Swithin,
I want to say to you too, you know, you're absolutely correct. Fathers do matter. They matter a lot. Mothers matter. Love in a household matter. Now, what are you doing to educate our young men and women that if you're gonna have, you know, a relationship with a young lady, there's a possibility you may have a child. How are you preparing the young people that child needs a dad and a mom? How are you doing that as far as teaching children about their reproduction system and if to have a child and if not to, and if you do, what happens after that?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, we're dealing with things we've never dealt with in our society. Kids are becoming addicted to pornography as early as 9 or 10 years old. And so I don't think sex education is the answer. You know, at the end of the day, it comes down to motives, right? I can try to be a moral person all day long. I can try really, really hard, you know, but I have certain proclivities. I like to drink. I like to party. I like women. I have proclivities that have been in my family for generations. And no matter how hard I try, it doesn't seem to work. You can try really hard to be moral, and you may get some victory here and there, but I'm just going to be honest. You know, when I'm faced with temptation, the reason I choose not to to partake is because I love Jesus, and I don't want to hurt him. I want to please him. I want to obey him, and he's given me his spirit. It lives within me, and so I have the power inside of me to say no to things that I've never been able to say no to. And so why would these young people turn away from what the world's telling them is perfectly okay? That you can have premarital sex and you can have as many partners as you want. Even though if you have 10 partners or more, the statistical likelihood of you getting a divorce is literally exponentially higher than the national average. Your chances of getting a divorce if you go into marriage a virgin is almost below 10%. We have these types of statistics at our fingertips. We know what the right thing to do is. We know what is morally acceptable within the church, but the world is screaming something completely different.
Right.
So how do we educate kids? This is it. This is the answer that I'm going to stick with, and that is we teach kids about the love of Jesus. And we teach kids about his morals and his standards. And when they have a relationship with him, they are way more likely to be moral and to make good decisions. We've tried every other means to get kids to do the right things, and you can try to educate them all you want, but it's a supernatural thing to go against the grain of this world that's screaming a completely different moral code. I think is impossible.
Well, Elena, we talk a lot on our show about social media and the outside influences and interferences that our children are faced with. But I have to say, in my personal life, I have noticed my parents had 18 children together. And what worked in our family was the education, watching the personal struggles that my mother and father went through, lack of resources, lack of books to go to school, lack of money in the household for things that we needed, shoes and clothes and things like that. And my mother would sit us down and she would tell us, look at my situation. So when you grow up and you get married or you get a partner in life, make sure you try to choose somebody, a gentleman with ambition, somebody who has a job, somebody who has land, somebody who has money. Because without resources, when you bring children into the world, literally, she would say, a dog on the street is better than you and your children. So in our case, the example set by my parents was, because of their trials and tribulations in life with having so many children, and we had faith and we had a great foundation, but we listened to our parents. And I think what you're saying is, if you love Jesus and you love God, and you put them in that same category as loving someone that you want to make pleased, you would listen to your scripture. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and you bring up a good example, right? So, you know, when we grew up, we were very poor. We grew up on Section 8 housing and food stamps, at least for the first, you know, 10 years or 12 years of my life. And so we were very poor. I know what it's like to go to bed hungry, right? And so when kids experience that kind of trauma and they hear advice from their parents, or whether they hear advice or not, right, they're thinking, man, I need to make sure that I'm not poor when I grow up. Well, in my situation, that led to me idolizing money, right? Because I'd grown up so poor, I said to myself, man, I don't ever want to have to deal with this when I grow up. And I saw the mistakes that my parents made. I don't want to deal with
it. And it made you a better person, right? But Ellen is telling me we have to wrap up the segment. Can you tell us where we can find the movie? Because our producer, Danny, would love to spread the word to the churches that support our station here. They would like to send them that link to the movie and how to get a hold of you, because Danny's nodding his head, and I think he really appreciates what you're doing for the young people in America and the mentoring and what you're saying about how to get America back on track again.
Yes, ma'am. Well, there's the full-length documentary, and there's also a 35-minute version that can be played in lieu of a sermon or played for Sunday school or for a small group. And you can find both of those links. They're both free. If you go to www.fatherlessepidemic.com, that'll also give you a way of getting a hold of me. It'll also provide a three-lesson Bible study for free and a bunch of other resources. So that's where you go, fatherlessepidemic.com.
Well, we will make sure we get that out to all of our folks here in our listening audience, as well as all over the World Wide Web that listen and subscribe to our show each and every week. We're going to take a quick minute and listen to our sponsors here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
Fine Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. Delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County and Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at cloud9.com. That's cloud9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for cloud9, mattress and furniture.
Welcome to MedFast Urgent Care. We are Brevard County's largest urgent care network. MedFast is now open at 7:30 a.m. every day. That's right, 7:30 a.m. every day. We will get you in and out so you can get back to your day. When you are sick or injured, MedFast is here for you 7 days a week. Think fast, think MedFast. With 18 locations, there's a MedFast near you. Call 321-MEDFAST.
Are you longing for a taste of Louisiana? Lizette's Cajun Bistro is the place to be. They offer Cajun and Creole staples as well as American, vegan, and vegetarian options. The restaurant is located at 2447 North Wickham Road, Unit 146. All menu items are prepared daily from scratch and made to order. Dine-in or takeout as well as outside seating. Live music on selected weekends. So the next time you have a taste for Louisiana, stop by Lizette's Cajun Bistro, 2447 North Wickham Road.
Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads. 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000 or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in, my goodness, it is a beautiful day today.
It really
We're
is.
Heard on WWBC AM 1510, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere, Miss Ellen.
Everywhere, 1510wwbc.com. You can hit the Listen Live button right after you get onto that website. And you can hear us on any one of your streaming devices, or if you'd like, you can hear our archive shows. You just pick by date. And then, of course, we share them on all of our pages, which is our website, cetamediainc.com, and as well as our two or three Facebook pages under Sita's personal page, under Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and cetamediainc.com. And, of course, we share all the shows after they're quickly edited and so forth, so everyone can share and download those right from that website.
What a great segment we just had.
Yes.
It's always good to learn things. And, you know, as we get older and bolder and wiser, we do want to leave a good footprint behind on planet Earth.
Amen.
And if it means you're going to have fate, whatever fate you choose, good for you.
Just believe in something. And the first
something
thing is
good.
To believe in something. Believe in yourself as well. So
our second segment, Ellen, you are going to love this guy because he has your last name.
I know.
Kind of, sort of. Sean O'Neill.
I love Ellen's and I love O'Neill's. So
Sean O'Neill. He's an author, award-winning screenwriter, and filmmaker. He holds a Bachelor of Commerce and an MBA. He's a former CEO who left the executive world behind at 52. Wow, something that we all should look to do as well.
Yeah, I left it a little earlier, but nonetheless,
yes,
it was a good move on my part too.
Yeah, and he's calling in from Toronto, and you said we do have a Toronto connection. Now we have a lot of guests that call in from Toronto.
We do.
Had Nandita that called in from the college.
That's right.
We've professor, had right?
So
Sean, we're not going to read the whole bio because it's so nice to have you just tell us a little bit about yourself. and how you ended up becoming an author, an award-winning screenwriter, and filmmaker. Talk to us.
Well, I guess to make a long story somewhat short, after 30 years in corporate, I've been very successful, and I'd always believed that my career was intended to be in that sort of environment, being an executive, being in the technology field, being in the startup sort of world, and I did enjoy it for a number of years, but it got to the point where, frankly, it was the same thing over and over again, and there was something inside me looking at me saying, well, you can do more in this world than you've done, right? So I had a good friend who's also a Canadian best-selling author constantly telling me, he says, you know what, you're the best storyteller I've ever met in my life. And he goes, one day, you know what, you got to actually sit down and write a book. So at 52, as you mentioned, I realized that, you know, I had been doing this for 30 years, and it was time to take a shot at doing that, you know, other passion that I had of storytelling in life. So I went to Africa for 2 months and crafted my first book while I was there. And, you know, personally, when I did do that, I thought this was going to be something that's, you know, more for me, my family, and, you know, some of my friends and so on. And when I got back and shared it with people, the feedback was very positive. And, you know, I was encouraged to continue to go from there.
Yeah, I read that, and you missed your daughter's birthday when you were in Africa.
I did. Thank you for pointing that out.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, it's on national radio.
But
great.
You brought her back some really nice gifts, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, I had a porcelain vase made in Egypt while I was there. And her name is Sahala. So I went to the Sahara Desert, and I scooped some sand from the Great Pyramids, and I scooped some sand from the Tombs of the Pharaohs. And I brought her back two vases, with that sand in it. And I will tell you, it was not an easy challenge sneaking this through various customs forces along the way.
I can imagine.
I got it home. It's on her shelf to this day. And I think she's forgiven me for missing that birthday at this point.
So you were finding yourself in Africa. Why Africa? Of all countries, was there something about Africa that drew you to that place? Or how did you end up there?
Well, I've always enjoyed exotic travel. So in my career, I was lucky enough to, I've been to India 5 times, I've been all through Asia, I worked in Israel, I've worked through the Middle East, Europe. I've never been to Africa, and there was, I think, two things that drew me to it. The exoticness of it, and the fact that I hadn't been there, and secondly, it's the cradle of civilization. So there was something about that appealed to me as well.
So your books, you don't stick to one type of books. You have like 3 different types that you write about?
I do, yeah. So all my books have the commonality of thriller. I write quick-paced stories, you know, the Clive Cussler, Dan Brown type of stuff. I write it a little differently. So I have a series of romantic thrillers that take place between an Irish American Boston cop, and a beautiful Punjabi brilliant woman from India. So I may be playing a little bit of, but it ended up becoming my highest rated trilogy. The first one is Brian's Dream, the second one is Miracle Sara, being my daughter, and the third one is Perminder's Legacy, and it takes place almost fully in India, the last. But I'm more known for my apocalyptic series and for my supernatural thrillers as well. I am writing a bit of an erotic thriller right now, so a little bit out of my space. The thriller part, I constructed the book and, you know, the nature of it, but I brought in a co-writer to help me with some of the scenes.
Wow. So how long did it take you to write, you said 6 months? Now, let's talk a little bit about The Chosen. That's a series. Is that the series that you're talking about, the brutal child murders that took place in Belfast, was it?
Yeah, so The Chosen is based on, it's an Irish story that takes place in a combination of Belfast and Dublin. A lot of my stories come to me in dreams. I'm on the scale, the autism scale, so my brain sort of functions a little bit differently than typical. So these stories come to me in a dream, and this one came to me in a dream. I was a huge horror fan growing up, so a lot of my horror style books take components or memories that I've had of films that I enjoyed over the years. So this one has a feel of an Angel Heart type feel to it. Just in 1970s to 1990s Irish, as opposed to the south of the U.S. as Angel Heart was done. I've been told that the first part of the book feels a lot like the movie Belfast, as it takes place in 1972.
Sounds like you were on this earth before.
Old soul.
Yeah, you're an old soul, because for you to be getting these visions and these dreams, and then you're able to wake up the next day and put it into your book and your characters, that's amazing. That's brilliant.
I have been told about old soul, by numerous people over the years. Because, yes, I sometimes wake up in the morning going, how did I even come up with that? Now, the advantage that I've had is that I developed the skill to be able to take that dream, take that thought, that story, and put it into a written book. And from there, I'm now able to turn it into a film script, and I actually do the pre-production now for films. So I've managed over the last 6 years to go from, hey, I don't want to be an executive anymore, I think I'm going to write a book, to actually starting to piece all the parts together to create, I think, an even bigger story going forward.
Well, you're the person that everyone talks about when they say find a purpose in your life and go with it. And you have certainly found your purpose. And you don't follow any standards when you're writing your books. You just write from your heart. And I like what you said, that people are writing a book, and those who read the book and enjoy it, they just want a good story. They don't really care about your grammar and this and that. They just want a good story that they could sit down and turn from page to page and say, wow, I'm not going to get up until this book is finished. And I think that's how your books are.
Yeah, that's the feedback I get from people. I will admit, in the early days, the structure of the book, the story was great, but from let's say a book's perspective, it needed a bit of work. I'm fucking around now, I'm a good editor, so everything is polished. It's the story. I do think differently. I don't follow any particular style. It's considered C-style, mostly. I tell a story that you don't want to put the book down. And I get that all the time. People, they just keep flipping pages. And I also like to say, it's a great escape from your normal world for the price of a cup of coffee.
Yes. Well, creativity isn't taught, right? Creativity is a gift. And storytelling is a gift. It's a gift of holding someone's attention to what's coming out from your heart. And that's how you write.
Yeah, it's funny. I also tell people, I know a number of writers and folks in the film business now. We have a lot of discussions about style and approach. And I tell the writers, I say, look, I don't write for writers. I write for readers. There are so many out there that want to nitpick, you should have used a more complex word, or you could make this more depth to this piece. And no, if the reader's enjoying the story, why would I try to take away from that?
Yes.
Right, and your ability to be able to interpret for the readers and be able to put a different twist and style, because I'm sure each one of your genre of books, so, horror to obviously erotica, is going to be a different way to tell a story.
And love.
Yeah.
And love stories.
Exactly.
And he also, one of your books, we were just coming out of COVID, and you wrote an inspiring story, a book about that as well. Tell us the backstory about the one that when we were just coming out of COVID.
So that's the Omega variant, and that one actually didn't come in a dream, I'll be honest. It came from, sadly, watching too much news.
Oh.
And what I saw, my interpretation, I looked at the situation, and I saw, a world that was confused, and it polarized the world. And so the book speaks to the next round of COVID, which, God forbid, does not happen, but in 17% mortality rate. And unfortunately, what it does in 2025, it polarizes America. So there's those who say, fake news, not going to believe it. And then there's those who say, oh no, this is dangerous, we got to put up barriers. So it splits America, and it starts to create the basis of a civil war. And then I bring in my style again, and I bring in a gray man, who comes onto the scene, and it becomes supernatural towards the end. And you start to see that there's purpose behind what's happening.
You've got quite an imagination, my friend, because you're so correct. Because, you know, during COVID, of course, being a long-term care nurse, we had to protect the most vulnerable, the elderly and the children and ourselves and our families. And I tell you, we depended so much on the news and what was happening in New York or other places. And some of us listened to Dr. Fauci and what he had to say, and some didn't. And even the nursing staff, the medical professionals, were fighting amongst themselves. People were so confused. Yeah. They just, some people didn't want to believe we had a COVID-19 was this bad, big bad virus. And some people wanted to just, you know, point it off as nothing. That it's just a nothing. It's just a cough. It's just a cold. And people were confused. They didn't want to listen to the scientists. They didn't want to listen to the professionals who went to school for this. So I'm glad you wrote that book. That maybe there's something in it that people could actually take away from it.
Well, I think the biggest message is that at the end of the day, if you have, you know, two camps believing two different things, you're going to have conflict. You know, it's inevitable if there's a board of governmental structure. I wrote the book, but I'm concerned about the message in it too, to be frank. But I think it reflects a possible future, one that I hope does not occur, but it does. It reflects the possibility of the going beyond just polarization. What's the next step? Some sort of a conflict, whether you call it a civil war or something else. In my book, I'm an external force, which helps explain what's happening to the world.
Yeah, you would hope that people would read books, and the most authors have a message in their books, and it's usually something good. They want to save something. They want to, whether it's the environment, whether it's the human race, whether it's finding the cure for something. People write because oftentimes it's almost like they're cleansing their own soul. They're writing something. And it's up to the person reading the book to say, this is what I got from it. So maybe that's what they'll take away from that book. So what is your favorite place to write? Where do you find it is your quiet place when you're home now in Toronto?
So I enjoy writing at the home in the summer here. It's just got such a beautiful vista, wonderful backyard, pool, and gardens and so on. But I will be honest, where I am most productive, creative, imaginative as I write is while I'm traveling. So I'm just a nut for traveling to different places. And there's nothing more that I enjoy than sitting on a train in a foreign exotic country and writing. That's maybe a little bit of a quirk of character, but that's what absolutely does it for me.
Well, I don't know how foreign we are, but here in Brevard County, we're getting a new train.
Yeah.
So it's it goes from Miami to Orlando, so we would love to have you. Cito will make you some curry chicken. You'll be all set.
Yeah, you'll have to bring the wife, too, if I'm going to make curry chicken.
So, yes, I would enjoy that. She would as well.
Yeah, so you said that The Lord of the Rings is what got you into writing, and then you grew up in science fiction as a youngster, and then, of course, everybody knows about Stephen King and Dan Brown and Clive Cussler. You love thrillers, and you have 12 books that are thrillers, is what I'm reading?
Yeah, I've got 12 of my own. I've got a 13th that I wrote with a very well-known Canadian politician. So he wrote a young adult fantasy book some years back, but couldn't get it anywhere. So I came in and I kind of gutted it, edited it with him, and we jointly published it. It's really his story in his book, but I helped bring it to fruition for him. And I'm working on numbers, my own books, numbers 13 and 14. Both are nearly done. One is Jill, J-H-I-L, the one I mentioned about the erotic. It's basically 50 Shades of Black in 1953 post-war Tokyo. And then the other one I'm working on is another supernatural Irish one, 1970s Galway, west coast of Ireland, Banshees, spirits, and so on. It's called the Galway Banshee.
Boy. So I want to tell you really quick, really 30-second story. My entire family from the 1500s dates back to Armagh, Ireland. So if you remember the phrase, the Riot Act, my family was all part. That was the court case that phrase came out of, because we were Irish Catholics and we were in a town that where the Irish Catholic and the Protestant church were very prevalent. So my family were a bunch of, you know, fighting in the streets people apparently back then.
But so you're giving them an idea. You're giving them an idea.
Well, it's just, you know, there's all these little moments in history. And it's an O'Neill thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know what's amazing about you, Mr. O'Neill, is it's almost like there's so many people living in your head. You've got all these.
They are.
I mean, it's wonderful though, because you're able to write so well. But in addition to writing all these books, you also have the screenplays. So if somebody wanted to learn a little bit more about you and about The Plague, The Chosen, and all the things you've done, The Omega Virant, all the books, what is your website and how do they get a hold of you?
So my main website, my book site, is www.sean-o'neill-writer.com. And that site will cover all my books, covers my history, my bio background, and so on. It also has a link to my film site. So I do mostly just my own adaptation, adapt my own stories to film, and we're currently working on co-producing the first one, The Chosen.
You know, you remind me of Ernest Hemingway in some ways. You really do.
that's actually one of my heroes.
So really quickly, in your opinion, what's the difference between being a CEO and being a producer of a movie?
I'm doing something that I'm passionate about and I create. As a CEO, I orchestrated things, which is a little bit different.
Okay, right.
I'm not gonna lie. I was a lot better paid as a CEO.
Now, we have like a minute left, and I wanted to ask you really quick. You did get a lot of film awards and recognition as well for a couple of your films. So tell us really quick, what were some of the awards you got?
So there's a series of film festivals that cover screenplays as well. So I've won a number of those, mostly for The Plague, The Chosen, and for Demons, one of my other books. And I've been a participant in the finals in many of them. It's a process by which you get found in that industry. It seems a lot of writers can't make the jump from writing a novel because it's third person and it's, you're inside the heads of the participants in the book, to, you know, sort of the first person. You can't talk about what's in their heads because you have to show everything. A lot of writers struggle with that jump. However, in my case, my books are very visual to begin with, so I've made the jump quite
quickly. Yeah, you wake up with a movie in your head playing.
I do. I've got eight more already in preliminary work.
So Sahara is your daughter, and Parminda, is that your wife's name?
My wife's name is Balbinder, so I changed that one a little bit just so that I didn't get in trouble with her.
I see.
Well, before we get thrown off air here, Mr. Sean O'Neill, thank you so much for sharing your story. We'll make sure we get all of your links out to all of our listening audience. And once again, another fantastic edition of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Please join us each and every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on 1510 WWBC.